From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the tensions behind a Kalamazoo campout protest by people who are homeless.
Kalamazoo at one time was named one of the meanest cities in the country towards its homeless residents.
The latest attempt to kill off Obamacare plays out in a Texas federal courtroom.
Love or hate the Affordable Care Act, the law still matters here. And I think this is likely to be laughed out of court.
A Hall of Fame teacher on school reform.
School reform today does not really improve the students' learning. It creates more obstacles. It makes it so teachers cannot innovate because that evaluation or that test score is looming around the corner.
And Michigan's last stagecoach robber.
In 1889, he makes his way into Gogebic County in western Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and he holds up a stagecoach.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Since August 19th, a group of protesters has been camped out in Bronson Park in downtown Kalamazoo. Many of them are homeless. They're demanding better access to services and housing for Kalamazoo's homeless population. Here are some of those protesters.
My name is Faith Felichtra. Everyone here in Tent City calls me Turtle. I was born in Kalamazoo. I've lived probably about half my life in Kalamazoo. I have been out here on the streets, well, since end of March, beginning of April. It's hard. And with the lack of support from people of the city and from the shelters we do have that are supposed to help us, we're silenced. We're being forced to shut down and be told that we can't say certain things, we can't do certain things. And we look at it as this is our freedom of speech.
My name is Shane. I've been out here for a couple weeks now, but I've been part of the protests since close to the beginning. All these guys here that are part of this movement, they're all family to me. This is my family. This place is a safe haven for all. A city commissioner, Sykes, is right there by that bench, sitting on the ground. She believed in our movement so much she joined us out here, which is really nice. But the city official that was here yesterday and gave us options and then turned his back on us when we wanted him to hear our demands, that wasn't right. It wasn't right at all. I mean, we listened to him. The least he could have done is listen to us instead of turning his back and walking away.
My name is Chris Jackson. I was homeless one time, so I've been there and done it. But I'm just out here just to tell them there is hope. When everybody is trying to bring you down because you're homeless, always keep a positive mindset that things will be better.
On Monday, the Kalamazoo City Commission unanimously agreed to address the demands of the Bronson Park protesters. That came after City Commissioner Shannon Sykes-Nearing laid into her fellow commissioners at a meeting last week. Here's some tape we pulled from an MLive recording of that event.
The decision not to allow discussion on this was a cowardly move. That was a decision of cowards. Point blank. You can't have a conversation with our residents? Y'all ain't got time to talk about it? Shame.
Kalamazoo City Commissioner Shannon Sykes-Nearing, welcome to Stateside. And before we get into what was agreed to this week, give us some background. Just what sparked this protest back in August?
You know, this conversation around homelessness and displacement has been going on in Kalamazoo for some time. Many of the organizers who are organizing this protest were organizing back in 2012 and all the way back in 2007. And so, you know, Kalamazoo at one time was named one of the meanest cities in the country towards its homeless residents. And so ever so often we have our homeless residents have just had enough. And this just happens to be the first time that I was an elected official when this was going on. And so here we are.
And so here we are. So this protest is essentially organized by Kalamazoo's homeless population.
It is. I think this time it was sparked by a conversation that the city was having around decriminalizing some of our ordinances. And as we decriminalized some of the park rules around sleeping and whatnot, there were specific things that were strengthened, like how long you can sleep in the park without being in trouble, whether or not you can sleep at night or during the day. And some of those things were strengthened. So that's what caused or prompted protesters to come out yet again.
And earlier this week, the city commission agreed to address the demands of the protesters. So exactly what has the commission and city agreed to do?
So the protesters have offered us 5 demands. One of those we've already addressed because the first demand was simply that we as a commission talk about it publicly, talk about the issues publicly. And you know, unfortunately, we did not do that for a while. So happy to say we did have that conversation on Monday. So that demand has been met. The rest of the demands are things that while we may not be able to address them ourselves as a city, we can definitely be conveners in getting some of those things addressed. So we've committed as a commission to support our city manager, and we have directed him to do his best to reach all of the demands with the protesters.
Break down those demands for us.
The first one was simply that we would talk openly and publicly about the issue. The second one was that we would be willing to investigate our local Kalamazoo Gospel Mission, which is the only overnight shelter that we have here in the city of Kalamazoo. There are numerous alleged abuses that have occurred within that shelter. And from the homeless folks that I've spoken to, their feeling is that our police department has not been willing to investigate that. And so, you know, we have reiterated as a commission that we fully intend for our police department to investigate any criminal abuses coming out of the local shelter. And other abuses probably are not in our jurisdiction, such as ethical abuses and whatnot. After that, folks are asking for full access to mental health and physical health care. Unfortunately, a number of the people who are living in the encampment need mental health care, are without medications, or have physical health needs that are too extreme for them to be allowed to stay at the shelter. For instance, one woman has epilepsy, and that makes her too much of a liability for her to stay in the shelter overnight. And again, that's not something we do as a city, but that is definitely something that we can encourage our other organizations to support. Number 4 is they're looking for a building. They'd like building or a number of structurally sound houses to one another. You know, the city and the county have got a number of empty, dilapidated properties, and they're simply asking for one that's structurally sound so that they can, along with volunteer contractors, fix it up and have it ready for them to move in before the snow comes. And then finally, which is a much longer term goal, they're asking that we develop a housing first strategy for the entire city so that moving on into the future, we don't have these same sorts of gaps that occur within our homeless community.
All right, now I have to ask you about what we heard at the beginning of this interview. That was quite the tongue lashing that you gave to your fellow commissioners. So why did you feel you had to do that?
Oh, man. You know, because it's taken entirely too long for us to get to this point. I started my term back in 2015, and the very first meeting I had with my colleagues was in relation to gentrification, displacement, and homelessness. And I have been bringing these things up both publicly and privately for the last 3 years. There's good information out there, best practices that we can follow from other cities. But I've been really frustrated at the lack of willingness by my colleagues to really dive into these issues and address it. So when we got to the point that folks were protesting and sleeping on the steps of City Hall, I guess I was just really overcome by the absurdity of not even being willing to talk about it publicly.
So do you feel that action and your speaking out, do you feel like you helped move the needle on this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, sometimes it takes a little bit of tough love for people to move forward. And so, you know, by speaking up and bringing attention to this issue and afterwards sleeping in the park for about a week, you know, folks have come out to hear more. My colleagues and other members of the community, the homeless encampment is getting a good deal of support from our larger community. And the more people learn about this issue, the more that they realize that something has to be done. And I think their pressure was what led to my colleagues going ahead and talking about this and also being open to solutions.
Now, you just mentioned that you joined the protesters last week. Tell us, what was it about that experience that you learned that opened your eyes?
Oh, wow. Oh, so much. I think perhaps the biggest piece is seeing how far from the truth some of the complaints about the homeless protesters were. This is a group, they consider themselves family, and they organize everything from their meals, the donations that come in. They're organized. They keep a running list of needs. They support one another. They help each other take care of each other's kids. I'll tell you, there was one night that I was sleeping, and there's a gentleman living in the encampment, and his tent was right behind mine, and he is legally blind and has a very hard time moving around on his own. He's not eligible to go to the shelter because of his health conditions. And he had had an accident in the middle of the night in his tent. He had defecated on himself. And numerous folks also staying in the encampment got up in the middle of the night to help him get up and cleaned off and changed into clean clothes and cleaned out his tent for him and laid him back down gently to go back to sleep. And those are the sorts of things you see over and over and over in this encampment. Folks showing up for one another, folks taking care of each other. And frankly, I think that we all have a lot to learn from watching this community and the way that they support one another.
Shannon, this protest seems like it's the result of some very long simmering and unaddressed problems. What is really at the root of this in your view? Is it lack of affordable housing in Kalamazoo, an overall lack of respect for people who are homeless?
I think it's both. Our city has had a shortage of affordable housing units for years. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine who does research in this area sent me links to some old articles that show that the very first study we had in Kalamazoo about affordable housing shortages was in 1937. And so this is something we have been studying and talking about for decades, over and over and over again, with no real solutions. So I think that's one big piece of it. And then the other piece is absolutely a lack of respect for the homeless population. There tend to be stereotypes that say, you know, the homeless people are just people who don't want to work, who just want to, you know, get high and drink alcohol. And actually, we have folks living in the encampment who have full-time jobs, who go to school full-time, who are seniors living on Social Security, who are homeless for the first time in their lives, folks living on disability who just don't get enough to afford rent. And we've got to realize that these folks are people just like you and I, rather than demonizing them. And so I think some of the demonizing that has occurred has left us apathetic. And hopefully this protest helps to open our eyes to see that, you know, these are our neighbors, just like anybody else.
Kalamazoo City Commissioner Shannon Sykes-Nearing, thank you so much for speaking with us, Shannon.
No problem. Thank you.
And a special thanks to Adam Reyes at WMUK in Kalamazoo for sharing audio of the protesters in Bronson Park. Later in the show, how residents are helping to change the narrative of Detroit's neighborhoods with a podcast produced by the people who live there.
I think we have to get back to the strength of the neighborhood so that the people of the city can enjoy the fruits of downtown.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're constantly hearing that our states, our nation's schools are doing poorly, that our students compare terribly when ranked against kids in other countries. But let's look at context. Let's look at history to answer the question, just how bad are things in our classrooms, really? Matinga Ragatz is an instructional innovation consultant and speaker. She was Michigan Teacher of the Year in 2011, and she was inducted into the National Teacher Hall of Fame in 2017. She's with us now via Skype to explain why this narrative of negativity just might have an unsound basis. Matinga, I have to ask you, though. Late last month, we all learned over half of the 3rd through 8th graders in Michigan failed their M-STEP literacy test. What did you take away from that?
Cynthia, to be honest, I take nothing away. The M-STEP is not a true report card of your children's schools. It doesn't provide the correct feedback because it's not timely, does not allow retakes for improvement, and it measures poverty and the economic inequalities rather than the learning of the kids. So if anything, it quantifies the economic level of your students rather than their knowledge. So it's a faulty measurement of what's happening at the schools. Our kids can read. Teachers are teaching children to read. And I think that we should question the proficiency levels that these tests require and ask yourself, you know, whether this failing school narrative is a con or is it true? And I really encourage parents to go into their children's schools to understand what's happening in their school boards instead of listening to a narrative that sends them running for the hills, really.
Matinga, you say the way we test our students and measure their success today, it's all based on a landmark report from 1983 called A Nation at Risk. It came out during the Reagan administration. What did it say? What problems did it lay out?
The Nation at Risk was a well-meaning document, I think, but it was grossly misinterpreted and misquoted. And so it was a pretty big indictment on American education and brought in some big rhetoric that describe education systems like, you know, they were a threat to the nation. And it was linked to like an act of war. It was pretty strong. It hit the headlines and immediately everybody jumped on it.
This rising level of mediocrity.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it is very strong language. And so, and I'm thinking that the highlight of that document was this notion that education was causing the decline of a once mighty nation and killing the American potential, right? So it warned about the danger to national security and to our economic systems and how it was going to fall apart because our education systems, we needed to do something about that.
But you say this document was flawed. How so?
Well, it was flawed because it was not necessarily the truth. For example, the statistics that the Nation at Risk documents used calculated the test scores between the 60s and the 80s. But at the beginning, in the first decades, those tests were only taken by top level students. And so as the type of student that started taking the tests grew, the test scores appeared to lower. But then when the Sandia report, which is a report that was commissioned in the 1990s and done by the Sandia Laboratories in New Mexico, when that came out, they basically broke down the population of kids who were taking the tests, right? And so they saw that individually, these populations had a small increments of improvement every single year. But because the initial tests were taken by only the high level kids, it made it look like the nation was, quote, at risk.
So how is A Nation at Risk still shaping our national debate on education today?
It is. And it's being used, I think, in ways that are, you know, quite punitive because it continues this familiar get tough on issues and on people who are not the issue. And that becomes the basis of, quote, the school reform starting in the 80s.
When you say getting tough on people, do you mean on teachers?
Teachers and students, really, these are really punitive measures for little kids. I mean, these rigorous tests, nobody likes those. You know, like you just keep making the standards higher. More homework, more science and math, more basic curriculum. And then this whole idea of this accountability, and you saw that in the 90s a lot, it became a numbers game. And the numbers game became this route that legislated the impossible, which is, you know, the attempt to quantify knowledge and learning.
So how has this get tough on schools, on teachers, on students, how has that culture impacted kids in Michigan?
I think these particular notions have specifically affected teachers because, again, you're asking the impossible. And the legislation keeps moving the target, so it's very difficult to ever hit the mark. And also, you've removed the teachers away from the conversation. And you should know that the state of Michigan is pretty much the only state that has a practicing teacher sitting in the State Board of Education right at the table. This was the brainchild of Dr. Sue Gutierrez, who's a principal at Forest Hills Public Schools. And this was established in 2002. We are one of the only states that actually has a teacher at that table. And it's also really affected the students because school reform today does not really improve the students' learning. It creates more obstacles. It makes it so teachers cannot innovate because that evaluation or that test score is looming around the corner.
So in your view, what should school reform look like in Michigan? When we hear calls for school reform, what should that look like?
First, I would like to change that narrative. You know, when you put the schools in the hands of the experts, which are the educators, you see an organic revolution that is not reform, it's an evolution. I mean, the reform implies that somehow we are deformed of some way. So I would definitely return the conversation to the teachers. I would ask myself the question, you know, can bureaucrats really, bureaucrats who have a tough time creating a timely plan for fixing potholes, and they travel to those roads every day, and they don't travel through our hallways every day. So if they cannot fix the obvious, can they really be trusted to fix the stuff that they don't see. So I would definitely make it so that the school districts have much more control so they can be more responsive to the needs of the population. And I would definitely, you know, notice what is happening when the teachers have a louder voice. We stopped weaponizing test scores, and we are introducing social curriculums that put us back in the business of just growing decent human beings with skills to support their communities rather than, you know, growing children that can beat countries in different scores.
Matinga Ragatz is going to be a regular contributor to Stateside. She'll be here bringing us her insights into education and what's happening in our classroom. So, Matinga, thank you and welcome aboard.
It's always a pleasure. Wow, thank you.
Here is how the news typically works. A reporter pitches a story and then talks to experts and people in a community about that issue and then goes and writes up that story. The Morningside 48224 podcast turns that concept inside out. It invites residents of the Morningside neighborhood on Detroit's east side to tell their own stories in podcast form. This Michigan Radio project launched earlier in the year. On Thursday, the podcast will host a listening party on the rooftop of the Alger Theater in Morningside. Here to talk about this podcast is Michigan Radio producer Imani Mixon and Therese Clark, who's an artist and entrepreneur with a long, long family history in the Morningside neighborhood. Imani, Therese, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having us.
Therese, I want to start out by having you just kind of tell us a little about Morningside. How do you describe your neighborhood?
I would describe my neighborhood as a place of history. Besides the architecture, I would say the families. If there's not a first generation of people really in Morningside, someone has always been there. I feel like there's always a connection to the house that someone lives in. Either their family owned the house and moved out, rented it, bought it back. There's always some type of story like that, I feel, in Morningside.
And Imani, I know it's been a while since we've had you on to talk about the podcast. It was just starting out. So tell us, how has it evolved since its start?
For sure. I think the last time we came, I was just really excited to meet new people and see how the neighborhood changed since when I lived there in the early 2000s. So to now have that sort of real life experience, talking to people, seeing how they organize and talk and make things happen, and especially meeting trees, to see like how much impact one family can have on a whole block or a whole neighborhood when they're able to stay and like just keep their roots there has been the most beautiful thing. And just trying to not overstate my importance, but see what's happening there already and how I can either support it or like figure out what are the new cool things that are happening.
What have you learned from this experience about roots in an area?
Wow, yeah, that's real. I think there's this larger narrative about like, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, you can make things happen. And while that's true, I'm realizing the benefit of being in one place long enough to see how things work and don't work. And progress looks so much different when you see it up close.
And also just kind of thinking of, you know, my parents were here or my grandparents, and you kind of feel that knitting together through the years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know, Therese, you actually produced a Morningside 48224 episode earlier this year. Why'd you want to get involved in this project?
Well, Imani reached out to me, and I felt that it was the perfect time to do so since I just had started working in the neighborhood as well.
Well, let's take a listen to a clip from that episode.
On this episode of Morningside 48224, we're going to Belfort, where three generations of women in my family have lived for over 30 years.
Oh, boy. So, Therese, tell us more about what happens in this episode and what's going on.
Well, in this episode, you hear about two homes in Morningside, one being my paternal grandmother's and one being my maternal great-grandmother's, how they lived on the same street and how my parents met.
Oh, I'm already loving this. That's the kind of story. We need more of these kinds of stories. And there's another resident who'll be featured in some of the audio that'll be in is longtime Morningside resident Patricia Robinson.
I've been here, and I will continue to stay here you know, and after I leave here, I hope that my family will continue to keep this as a family home.
Oh, Imani, tell us about this woman with the most resonant, gorgeous, rich voice.
Yeah, for sure. Well, she's a part of Teresa's Balfour story, too. So she's in the family. It's still another, you know, maternal link to the chain. So, yeah, it's just great to know that someone who, you know, has just graduated college and is looking for a home for themselves can come and have roots, and also seeing people throughout the years make it happen, and especially if it's all coming from two sides of one family. That's beautiful.
And it's clear from what we just heard Patricia Robinson say, that she said, and when I'm gone, she'll still be there. She will still be there even when she has passed on, because the family's there. Her presence is still there. If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Michigan radio producer Imani Mixon and Therese Clark of the Morningside Neighborhood in Detroit as we talk about their work on the Morningside 48224 podcast that lets residents of this neighborhood tell their own stories. Imani, what's been the most surprising thing that you've learned along the way as you've created this podcast?
Wow, I think, I don't know if it's surprising or just cool, but I think it's great to realize the work that's already been happening there. So in the process of trying to figure out a network of people who are already there doing work, I came across two different podcast studios that are already set up and kind of running. So there's one run by John Galloway, who is affiliated, or like he runs the Audio Wave Network, which is like a group of different shows that he produces in that studio. And then also Pastor Bodley at Bethany Lutheran has a podcast studio on the upper floor that he's trying to get off the ground. So just to realize that we might be tapping into something worthy here if so many people are thinking the same way at the same time.
And taking it into their own hands, creating their own media,
exactly.
Not being caught out of whatever is being created elsewhere.
Exactly, and the support is there. Anytime I need help or have questions and vice versa, we kind of just make it a point to check in and see if we're thinking about things the right way.
So, Therese, I'm going to turn this on to you. What has been the most surprising thing that you've learned as you've worked on this podcast?
Well, I've learned that there's a lot of youth in the community that I didn't know we're still around. Just listening from stories that Imani has shared, or people who have reached out via social media, that I didn't know that so many people were from the same neighborhood as me. So that's the most surprising.
What do you think, Therese, that the media narrative does not get right about this neighborhood you call home?
Well, they don't get that there's a lot of entrepreneurship living within the streets of Morningside. And people are just waiting for the opportunity to make those things happen. What else is missing is, I think, the family stories, which Michigan Radio and Imani is kind of filling that void. So,
And there's this narrative of that we explore a lot, actually, on this program, the two Detroits, the attention being focused on downtown and Corktown and Midtown and bars and restaurants and all of that happening, but the feeling that that has not gotten out to the neighborhood yet. How do you think, and I'll start with you, Imani, on this, how do you think this podcast might say, hey, check these neighborhoods, because there's a lot going on?
For sure. I'm definitely biased toward Morningside because that's hometown. But I do think that people have a tendency to make something really dynamic into a static idea. So, yes, people come downtown and go to Midtown, but we got there so we can get back home, too. Like, people have full lives outside of the city center. And a lot of what happens in those neighborhoods dictates how successful you can have. If there's nobody around downtown, nobody's going to come downtown. So I think that that's something that needs to be underscored more, and that just as Detroiters here in the city, you know that there's so much richness beyond, you know, just one little circle in the city.
And what are your thoughts about that, the two Detroits narrative, Therese?
Well, I definitely think there is two Detroits. I feel it when I do things. Coming back home from being in Michigan State in 2011, I definitely saw the focus shift towards downtown, which kind of became the nucleus that we got away from, because the neighborhoods at one point were more important than downtown was. So now it's kind of in reversal, but I think we have to get back to the strength of the neighborhoods so that the people of the city can enjoy the fruits of downtown.
I think I just have one more thing to add about that. Spending more time in Morningside and getting to know people, I think it's changed my requirements for a living space. Like, I'm in Midtown now and I love it and you can do everything, but it's like, okay, at what point do you get tired of like trying to find a place to park and a new coffee shop every 2 weeks? And when I do want a community meeting, when I do want a block club, when I do want to do like the bigger community work that goes to living in a place, where do you go and then what's available for you?
All right. So much to be explored. And I know, Imani, there's a listening party tomorrow. Tell us more about that. What can people expect?
For sure. We'll be on the Alger Theater rooftop, which is sort of a mainstay in Morningside. They've recently gotten renovated, so it's a whole new space. And I just really want it to be a casual way for people who haven't met to meet each other, maybe see some faces instead of just hear some voices on the podcast, and just air out any ideas that they have or conversations that they think need to be had. So I think it'll be fun. I just want it to be fun.
And I think you're going to get good weather. So that's just all plus as well.
Yeah.
We've been talking to Therese Clark and to Michigan Radio producer Imani Mixon as we talk about the Morningside 48224 podcast. And again, the listening party at the rooftop of the Alger Theater in the Morningside neighborhood in Detroit's East Side. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Coming up, a train robbery, a stagecoach robbery, and a neurological miracle are just two of the highlights in our Michigan history segment today. That is in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier this week, Governor Snyder submitted a waiver to the federal government which asked for permission to impose work requirements on people who get their health insurance through Healthy Michigan. Meanwhile, a lawsuit recently argued before a federal judge in a Texas courtroom threatens the future of the Affordable Care Act. Here with us to break it all down is Nicholas Bagley, a professor at the University of Michigan Law School, where he specializes in health and administrative law. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to first start by getting your thoughts on Medicaid work requirements, because this week Governor Snyder submitted a waiver to require people on Healthy Michigan to work for their health insurance benefits. He said it's necessary to keep Healthy Michigan going because the way the law is written, there's this poison pill that if the waiver isn't approved, Healthy Michigan is over. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, so the Michigan legislature has insisted on stitching work requirements into the Medicaid program. And work requirements have some facial appeal, right? If you're going to be taking government money to cover your health insurance, you might as well work for it. Don't sit on your duff playing video games in the basement all day. The trouble with that story is that the vast majority of people on Medicaid already work. The few that don't work are actually taking care of dependent children, taking care of dependent adults, or they're sick themselves, or they're in school. So the number of people who might be induced to work is actually quite small. But the universe of people who have to document all of their hours is really large. And if you think about how complicated healthcare is, you know, a lot of people who are on Medicaid barely know they're on Medicaid, much less know how to comply with these work requirements. And so an awful lot of people are going to struggle simply to do the paperwork that's required to document that they're working. And the result of that is likely to be that maybe about 100,000 people, maybe more, in the state of Michigan will lose their health insurance. Some of those people will be working, but they just won't be able to deal with what I like to call paperwork requirements.
So what legal recourse is there if the governor's waiver is approved?
Well, right now there's a lawsuit pending in Washington, D.C., challenging similar work requirements for Kentucky's program. And a district court judge in D.C. said that work requirement waiver that was granted was unlawful. There will be almost certainly a similar lawsuit brought to any waiver granting Michigan's work requirements. Whether that lawsuit is successful remains to be seen. The state of Kentucky will certainly appeal to the D.C. Circuit, and from there, possibly even to the Supreme Court. So there's a long road ahead when it comes to the legality of work requirements. But for now, they're already rolling out in Arkansas, they're about to roll out in Kentucky, and they're likely to roll out here. And the result is that many thousands of people will lose their insurance coverage.
I want to move over to the lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. It's before Judge Reed O'Connor of the Federal District Court for the Northern District of Texas. So briefly explain who brought this case and why.
There's a group of Republican attorneys general who decided to bring what you might think of as a rear guard, last ditch, constitutional challenge to the entirety of the Affordable Care Act.
But Michigan's not one of these.
Michigan's not one of them. Attorney General Schuette has been a relentless opponent of the Affordable Care Act from the beginning. This is the first time I've seen him sit one of these out.
What are they arguing?
The challenge arises from Congress's decision to eliminate the individual mandate penalty at the end of 2017 as part of tax reform. The individual mandate has obviously been very controversial, and Congress said, we don't need this.
And it was really a linchpin for the Affordable Care Act.
It was really a linchpin for the Affordable Care Act, and the Republican Congress said, look, even if it's a linchpin, it's too much of an incursion on individual liberty to be tolerable. So we're going to get rid of it. And whatever the consequences are, we'll roll with them. And maybe that'll be bad for the health insurance markets because fewer healthy people will enroll, which means that rates for everybody who remains will go up. But they thought those costs were worth bearing to get rid of the individual mandate. Now, the Republican state attorneys general say, actually, when you repealed the individual mandate penalty, you created a constitutional problem. And their argument is complicated, but their argument is that when the individual mandate was sustained by the Supreme Court back in 2012, it was sustained under Congress's power to impose taxes. Well, now that the tax has been zeroed out, they say the individual mandate, it cannot be justified as a constitutional matter. And they say that the instruction, the naked instruction, the unenforceable, penalty-free instruction to buy insurance, they say that's still on the books, and that's unconstitutional. Now, I can't get too worked up about this constitutional debate because who cares whether an instruction that is not backed up by any penalty is enforceable or not? It's the next move that the attorneys general make that's really the audacious one. They say, okay, look, because of this problem, this perceived constitutional problem, which I don't think exists, but stipulate that it does, we think not only does the individual mandate that remains in place need to be struck out of the law, we think the entire statute has to fall. Why do we think that? Well, because back in 2010, Congress, when it passed the Affordable Care Act, said that the individual mandate was really important to the Act's proper functioning. And so they say, well, maybe when Congress repealed the individual mandate in 2017, if it had known that it was creating this constitutional problem, maybe it would have been of the same view. And maybe it would have preferred just to wipe out the entirety of the ACA. It's an audacious argument. It's, frankly, a frivolous argument, an argument that virtually no commentator across the political spectrum has endorsed. It is nonetheless an argument that this highly conservative judge that they purposefully filed in front of appears pretty sympathetic to.
I want to have you explain this to us. The case is Texas versus the United States.
Yes.
So the federal government is the defendant, but the Trump administration has sided with the plaintiffs in this individual mandate. What's going on here?
Yeah, this is one of the more, actually, I think the most troubling part of this lawsuit. You know, when the lawsuit was filed, I think responsible legal commentators said this is not a serious lawsuit. This is an effort on the part of Republican state attorneys general to burnish their credentials with their base. Every Republican state attorney general wants to be governor someday. To do that, you have to win a primary election. And so this is a political stunt. I thought at the time, actually, the bigger concern was that the Trump administration would then be forced to make a tough choice. Traditionally, the Justice Department defends acts of Congress. That's its job. And it's an important job. And it's one that the Justice Department takes very seriously because we don't want the executive branch to pick and choose the laws that it'll defend. All the laws that Congress passes ought to be enforced and upheld.
Given defense.
Exactly. So the Trump administration, in the normal course, would have defended this statute. But this is the Affordable Care Act. The political controversy surrounding health reform prompted them to change their tune. And instead of defending the lawsuit, they threw the law under the bus. And they said, we agree that the statute is unconstitutional. They don't think the entire ACA has to fall, but they think that some of its most important provisions have to go. Community rating, which means that insurers have to charge everybody, sick and healthy alike, the same rate, that would go away. The requirement of an insurer to sell you insurance if, say, you have a pre-existing condition, that would go away.
And people, they may not like the Affordable Care Act, but they like the pre-existing condition protection.
Well, a lot of people think of health reform and they think Obamacare. And so it's really a referendum on how you felt about the previous occupant of the White House or about Democrats. when you actually drill down on what the Affordable Care Act did, people tend to support it. They tend to say, oh, I like that part of it. And the parts they dislike, like the individual mandate, are essential to supporting and sustaining the parts of the Affordable Care Act they do like.
We've even seen a group of Republican lawmakers try to introduce something saying you've got to keep the protections for pre-existing conditions.
Absolutely. That legislation actually doesn't achieve the goal that they'd set out to do. But I think what's one of the really interesting things about watching this lawsuit is to get a sense of the kind of political shift that we're witnessing. When the lawsuit was filed, I think these Republican state attorneys general thought that Republican policymakers would have their backs. But Republican members of Congress are lining up to walk away from this lawsuit. And in fact, in some really closely contested Senate races, Senate Democrats who are facing really tough campaigns are running on their opponents' support for this lawsuit. Joe Manchin in West Virginia just put out a wonderful advertisement where he actually takes a gun and shoots a copy of this lawsuit, saying that my opponent supports taking protections for pre-existing conditions away from people. So if this is a live issue and Democrats are finally starting to say, you know what, we believe in the Affordable Care Act, we think health reform is a winning issue for us, I think we're witnessing something very important shift in the political conversation.
But if Judge O'Connor rules, and you say he's very conservative, hey, you 20 attorneys general, you are right, and that in the individual mandate is unconstitutional, where does that leave us? Then what happens?
Well, I think it's likely he will, judging from the questions that he asked at a hearing last week. What exactly he does is, you know, he has a couple of different choices available to him. In all likelihood, whatever the judge does, it'll be immediately appealed. Any injunction that he might enter prohibiting the enforcement of the health reform law is likely to be put on hold pending appeal. I don't think we're likely to witness the end of the Affordable Care Act whenever the judge happens to issue his order. A stay will be entered either by the Fifth Circuit or by, if necessary, the Supreme Court. I also don't think on appeal the courts are going to have any patience with this lawsuit. Whatever this hard right judge in Texas might think about the arguments on display, they really are frivolous. And at the end of the day, love or hate the Affordable Care Act, the law still matters here. And I think this is likely to be laughed out of court. You can't write it off altogether, though. And when this judge issues his opinion, he's going to put some real force behind it and make it much more likely that we'll see some Republicans start to rally to it. When that starts to happen, who knows what might change in the conversation about the likelihood of this actually prevailing.
Nicholas Bagley, professor at the University of Michigan Law School, thank you so much for your insights.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and you know what that means. We're going to talk our state's history.
I've sent the following wire to President Truman. My heartiest congratulations to you on your election.
I'm aware of my blackness, but I don't go around and look and see whether I'm different than someone else.
Fail a lot quickly, and then eventually you'll succeed.
I worry that the person who thought up Muzak may be thinking up something else.
This week we have quite an interesting story involving an immigrant. His name was Raymond Holshay, an Upper Peninsula stagecoach robbery and brain surgery performed in prison. You could not script this story. And here is Rachel Clark with the Michigan History Center. So, Rachel, let's start at the beginning. Who was Raymond Holshay, and where was he born, and what brought him to the Great Lakes region?
Raymond Holshay, or Americanized version, Raymond Holsey, a lot of people pronounce it, was born in 1866 in Germany. He moved to Wisconsin when he was 15 to live with his uncle and work there. Ellis Island and Castle Garden records have him arriving May 26, 1882. And he worked there for a little bit and then started traveling west looking for work. At some point in time, apparently, he falls off of his horse and suffers a pretty traumatic brain injury. So he ends up back in Wisconsin trying to work, but he has a falling out with his uncle and ends up beginning his life of crime.
And from that injury, what kind of symptoms was he living with?
He starts to have seizures and blackouts. He's very angry. He has these fits of anger. Mm-hmm. And so those start to show up pretty quickly after his head injury.
Now, research by the Michigan History Center tells us all that Raymond has been called the last stagecoach robber in Michigan. So tell us what went down.
By the late 1880s, he's back in Wisconsin and he's robbing stagecoaches and trains. He's becoming quite a pain for the Wisconsin authorities. And he coins himself Black Bart after a short book at the time.
Okay.
And he, in 1889, he makes his way into Gogebic County in western Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and he holds up a stagecoach. But this time, as he's robbing the passengers, apparently somebody doesn't want to give him their money, and he ends up shooting them and killing them.
Ooh.
He spends a few days in the woods, and he's captured later in Republic, Michigan.
Do we have photographs of him? What do we know about what he looked like?
We do. We have the Archives of Michigan has a few photos of him after his capture. Because he was so renowned, not only in Wisconsin, but now he was the stagecoach robber in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
Perhaps notorious is the
he
word.
He was.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. So they took the opportunity to photograph him. So there is a photograph of him. It looks like he's sitting in a chair and handcuffed with the two men that captured him. But they also staged this photograph of him. And the archivists that worked on this research, the historians that worked on this research, and the exhibits people at the Michigan History Center, just they loved this story. And this photo in particular is interesting because he has a rifle in one hand, he has a sidearm and a holster on his hip, and then he's wearing a vest that's filled with shotgun shells. So he looks very sort of daunting and threatening, but the shells that he has in the vest don't fit either one of the guns that he has with him. So they weren't stupid. They didn't pose him with a gun and ammunition for the guns.
And sharp-eyed people noticed that was totally prop stuff.
They did. We have a few photos of him throughout his early time after he was arrested.
And we will have those photos posted on the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. So off to prison.
Yes.
And how did that go for him?
Not well. He's sentenced to two life sentences, one for murder and one for armed robbery, and he winds up in Marquette Prison. Within a year, he begins exhibiting violent outbursts. He takes a guard hostage, threatening to kill him. The guard escapes. He takes another prisoner hostage, and either a guard or the warden of the prison actually shoots him in the hand, and the prisoner gets away. Holtzey is put in solitary confinement, and he goes on a hunger strike. So time in prison for him is just as violent as his life was, and it's not going well for him at all.
So they transfer him to Ionia Prison in November of 1893?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened there?
What they realize is part of his skull is caved in, most likely from that injury when he fell off the horse. And so they do surgery to repair that. They remove part of his skull and replace it with a metal plate to relieve the pressure on his brain. He stays in Ionia for about a year and then is transferred back to Marquette in July of 1894, where he becomes a model prisoner. He becomes the prison librarian. He works in arts programs. And he actually, while he was at Ionia, learned about photography. Photography in prisons was new in the 1890s, and he learns about that. So when he goes back to Marquette, he brings this newfound enjoyment in photography with him.
So that surgery, which when you stop and you think about it, I'm sure neurosurgery in 1893 isn't particularly sophisticated, but clearly what happened and what the doctors and surgeons did to him helped him.
It did. He changes personalities entirely. He does become a model prisoner. He's given a lot more rights within the prison system, and he works in the library. He works with photography. He's no longer put in solitary confinement. He never has these outbursts anymore. So it very much changed his personality and his behavior.
And what about parole?
The warden of Marquette in 1912 recommends him for parole, and he receives it and is released in July of 1913. So he does end up getting paroled based on his behavior.
That's amazing when you stop and you think about what got him in prison. But it seems like there was an understanding that that behavior was based on medical trauma,
mm-hmm.
which actually to me seems pretty forward thinking. I mean, we're looking at that today as a reason people wind up behind bars.
It was Ionia Reformatory at that time. There was a hospital assigned to it. They really did look at different things back in the 1890s. 1900s, actually through the early 20th century, prisoners were moved from one location to another, especially if they were becoming a problem in one prison. You would just shift them to another prison in hopes that maybe they would behave differently. But with Ionia, because they had a hospital assigned to them or associated with them, they were able to look more at the medical side of issues, and Holtzey was a prime example of that.
So after 24 years, he's released from prison. Tell us about his life and how it played out.
It's not very happy.
Oh, no.
Initially, I know. Initially, he does odd jobs on the farms. He opens a photography studio in Marquette because of his love for photography, and he's very talented at it. He opens a photography studio under the name Carl Paul, but it doesn't take long for people to figure out who he is, and he ends up having to close the studio down. By 1917, he's moved to Yellowstone Park, and he's selling photos to tourists. So he does that for a while. And then in the 1930s, he buys a cottage in Florida. And so he goes back and forth between Florida. He still comes back to Michigan to visit people and friends and family. And he does that for about another 20 years or so.
Where was his cottage in Florida?
His cottage was on Captiva Island in Florida.
Okay, he did want retreat.
Yes,
he truly
he did. Very much.
How long did he live?
He lived until 1952, and unfortunately he committed suicide at his cottage in Captiva Island.
This does sound like the script of some kind of a movie, and I guess he did get around. He took photographs, but you're right, on the whole, it was not a happy ending to his life, was it?
No, it wasn't.
The tale of Raymond Holse, the last stagecoach robber in Michigan history, and his remarkable recovery. Rachel Clark is with the Michigan History Center. We always love talking history with you. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And that is Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.